Hello, welcome to Convergent Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I'm very happy to have Paco Calvo on the podcast. Paco is a cognitive scientist and philosopher of biology, known for his work in plant cognition and intelligence. He is the professor at the University of Murcia in Spain, where he heads up the Minimal Intelligence Lab and studies cognition. He looks at work from biology, philosophy, cognitive science to look at plant behavior. He is the author of the book, which has a co-author of Natalie Lawrence, called Planta Sapiens, The New Science of Plant Intelligence. And that's what we talk about in the conversation. We start by talking about plant blindness, how we move about in the world, we're in our environment, and we don't really see plants. At least we kind of see them as like a backdrop, and why we don't sometimes put a focus or an emphasis on plants. We talk about plant intelligence. We define intelligence, what it is generally, maybe for other organisms, and what it could look like for plants. Talk about sun tracking and internal representations. We bring up the work of Carl Friston, Andy Clark, in predictive processing, Bayesian brain, and how that applies to plants. We talk about what it could be like to be a plant. What is that experience like? We also discuss domesticated and wild plants, element of time, individuality of plants, ethics, and many more topics. This was such a fun conversation. I really, really enjoyed it. Paco is such an erudite guy. He's super, super, super smart, very, very affable. I greatly enjoyed the conversation talking about plants, something that, you know, we're always around, and being able to kind of think about them a little bit more differently. And so his book helps to do that. The conversation was very helpful for me in thinking about that. And so, as always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergentdialogues.substack.com, also on YouTube. So get over there, like, subscribe, follow, share with your friends, contribute. All of that is much appreciated. And now I bring you Paco Calvo. I am here with Paco Calvo. Paco, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm greatly looking forward to speaking with you.
Yeah, thanks, Javier. Yeah. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Of course, of course, of course. So you've written a remarkable book. I loved it dearly. I know many listeners will enjoy this one as well. The book is called The New Science of Plant Intelligence, which is a Planta Sapiens, sorry, is the title. And the subtitle is The New Science of Plant Intelligence. And it's fantastic. It's very readable. It's not terribly long, and it's packed with so many wonderful bits of information. I was really pleased with how you really blended a lot of the current literature and research from different areas. So it's not just, you know, botany or things like that. It's really coming from different elements of consciousness, cognitive science, obviously intelligence. So it's just fantastic all around.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, of course.
It's good to know that it's not too long, right? Short books are way better than long ones.
I think for most readers, they like the kind of digestible. Not everybody. I definitely love the 800 pager. So but it is also nice to mix it up. So it's very good.
Just a pill big enough that you can swallow it without.
That's right. That's right. Without choking.
Trouble.
That's right. So before we'll talk all about it. Before we do, why don't you tell listeners just kind of, you know, who you are, the most relevant parts of who you are academically, professionally, and how you came to write the book.
Yeah, well, I'm a professor of philosophy of science at the University of Murcia in Spain, Southeast Spain, and I'm the principal investigator of the Minimal Intelligence Lab, MINT Lab. And this is a special lab, right? I mean, you'll see from the book, we have this lab based in a philosophy department. And we study plant intelligence. So many people wonder, what the heck are you doing? I mean, how come you can study plant intelligence scientifically from within the philosophy department? But I guess that's something we'll get to talk about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's interesting. You had this this bit where we'll get to it. But you were, when you were in Edinburgh, you had this intersection of studying philosophy and psychology and plant biology to help understand plant cognition. So I guess maybe just a little bit here, how is that experience and what you're doing now, as you're saying it's in a philosophy department, it's not in a, you know, a botany or biology department. How is that intersection of sorts of those different disciplines or fields of study helpful to look at plants?
Yeah, well, I would say it's not just that you are able to do it, to accomplish the type of research we are doing, despite not being based in a botany or a biology department, or a cocci or psychology department, for that matter. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Not just that you are still able to do it, but that we couldn't do the sort of things we do any other way.
Mm.
So this, for example, the sabbatical in Edinburgh was like a triple appointment. I was appointed both in all three places, like the philosophy department. I was with a professor of psychology as well, and a professor of botany and the life sciences school. And precisely what I found truly enriching, not simply the fact that you could, you know, get to know all the plant literature or the cocci discussions or the philosophical, you know, big picture point of view stuff, but rather than that I realized that we weren't raising the type of questions I was interested in. So if you're in a botany or a biology department, you can get to know a lot, an awful lot about, you know, details or, you know, molecular or cellular biology or plant physiology, you name it. Even if you go to the developmental or evolutionary biology or ecology, but still, you are just getting a picture of plants as such. You are not raising questions like coming from the cognitive sciences, like could plants have intentions, scientifically speaking, not metaphorically speaking. That has to do with the very title of the book. When I say Planta Sapiens, I mean it literally. So it's not a metaphor. We mean it literally, right? So the problem is that if you go to a psychology department, something similar happens. So they say, sure, we study those things that you're interested in, cognition, intelligence, sentience, you know, attention, memory, learning, whatever, any cognitive capacities. And they would say, but the problem is that you or your model, in this case plants, have no neurons. Sorry, you can't study plants because you need neurons. Otherwise, our questions are, you know, we cannot address your concerns. So you see, either if you are from within a psychology or a botany department, you just don't get to see the whole picture. We needed to zoom out, to move outside of those domains and be able to raise the questions we're raising. Because these are not orthodox questions. And then you require a brand new way to look at it.
Yeah, I think that's probably the only way, or maybe not the only way, but it's probably a primary way of trying to answer this question, because it's obviously, you know, sort of counterintuitive to the things that we know. And there's some interesting things that you place in the book about kind of mapping a kind of type of thing. So, you know, plants will have a central nervous system, but they might have a type of system, you know, things like this. It's very, very interesting.
Sure.
So the question you kind of start with in the book, which I thought was interesting, even, I mean, for myself, I'm guilty of this as well. You talk about plant blindness, which is really, I thought was wonderful way to put it, is we just see, I think a lot of the times, I think it's right, it's definitely been true for me at different points, of we walk around on the world, in our towns, our cities, even our gardens, or, you know, we take hikes, we do all these things, we're in nature, but we don't see plants. They're just a kind of background. We're in the foreground, they're in the background, they're always, you know, the extras in the movie, the bit players in the play, all these things,
we
right?
Keep missing them.
We always miss them instead of having them at the forefront. And so I guess for us as humans, I had a few ideas about this, but I'm curious for your thoughts. Why do you think we kind of ignore plants much of the time? What is it about that for us as humans that we're not seeing them?
Yeah. Well, basically, to cut a long story short, we don't see anything. We are missing 100% of it, right? Because even, I mean, there are different levels of blindness. And my worry is not the standard understanding of plant blindness. I mean, people might be educated into saying, look at the flowers and look at the greenery. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it there? Please pay attention to it, right? So we could educate our children into appreciating the this background greenery and bring it up from. But we might still be suffering from the type of plant blindness I'm more concerned about. So in a non-risky sense, and something that we can all understand, in a sense, we are plant blind to the extent that we privilege motion. That, oh, if things go past fast, oh, that's something to pay attention to. It might be a predator. So evolutionarily speaking, it's good news that something moving fast grabs our senses, our attention, it catches our attention, right? So there's nothing wrong with that. We cannot see everything at the same time. We need to pay attention to parts of the scenery.
Yeah.
And that means missing other parts, right? That comes with perception.
Mm-hmm.
And something gets enhanced and something goes to the background, right? Mm. So that's part of what makes us successful in evolutionary terms. With that being said, even if we start to appreciate through education or whichever other means, you go hiking, what you mentioned, or just going for a stroll in your garden or mm-hmm. watering your plants at home, whatever, you try to pay attention to them, we might still be suffering from plant blindness insofar as you might spot them, notice them, and yet treat them as objects. So don't see them as agents, as subjects, with their own interests, doing their business, being there, hanging around, and with things that matter to them. So even when we see them, we still miss them. So it's not as easy as simply let's notice them.
Is that because they don't have a face? They don't have a body? Mm. Like even if we see insects, or if we see bees or birds, they have legs, or they have kind of appendages or digits, or they have eyes, or they have a face. Is it because plants just don't have that? It's almost familiar and foreign at the same time. Is that part of it, or what do you think?
Yeah. Oh, definitely, definitely. We can't help anthropomorphize, right?
Uh-huh.
Actually, this even affects to the way we interact with robots.
Mm.
I mean, if you have this robot and you put two eyebrows or eyelids and the robot is like looking at you like this, you empathize with
your
robot.
That's right.
So we tend to, to make robots human-like, right? Humanoids.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't help it. And it's easy to fool ourselves into inflating the non-cognitive activities of AIs and ignoring the truly genuine cognitive activities of other forms of life that simply happen not to resemble us. So one thing that comes with our nature is the need to project our point of view, our preconceptions, in a sense we can't help but providing somehow the gold standard against which we measure the capacities of any other organism, biological or artificial. And that's why many people are more keen to appreciating the doings of AIs, which are not doing anything at all from my point of view. But the illusion that there is something in there has to do with the fact that we are able to exchange or to maintain a conversation that apparently makes semantic sense, right? Oh, I'm chatting with this bot and the bot is responding in a sense that if a human was there, it would be exactly the same, right? So that fools us into thinking there is something related to us. So since plants, their ways of being in the world are so dramatically different from ours,
mm-hmm.
basically their behavior boils down to patterns of growth and not locomotion, mm-hmm. right? So the time scale is so different that it's just so difficult for us to put ourselves in their shoes, to see the world from their point of view and say, they are doing, within their sessile, they are just sitting there being rooted, taking life as it comes. And of course, it's not that point. But the point is that the temporal scale in which we are making our observations differs so dramatically from the temporal scale in which their behavior unfolds that we can't quite make those two converge.
Mm.
And thereby, we keep missing it. The problem is not the plants themselves, but thinking that we somehow have a gold standard.
Mm-hmm. This might be sort of speculative of sorts, but and I might be jumping ahead here, but what do we suspect that perhaps plants have views of other organisms in the world, including humans? So they have other animals, birds, bees, insects, but then also animals and then different mammals, including us. What do we think that at the very least, there is there some kind of two-way interaction there? Or is that purely speculative at this point?
Well, put it this way, think of any pattern of evolution. Strictly speaking, if you think about it, there is you will never find evolution as such, only coevolution. So put it this way, any pattern of intelligence has got to boil down somehow to collective intelligence, because you are never alone. You are interacting with other agents. So there is always a form of coevolution that amounts to some sort of arm race, right? So think of a flower and a pollinator. Again, because the way we pay due respect to the temporal scale in which the pollinator is doing its business, we somehow, you know, are inclined to appreciate the doings of the pollinator against the doings of the flower. And we just see the flower as the object and the pollinator as the agent with a point of view. So we could actually, with a little bit of imagination, picture ourselves in the shoes of the pollinator. Oh, the pollinator seeing the flower and trying to land on the petals, right? And grab the nectar and then thereby carry the pollen. But by the same token, that would make no sense if it wasn't a genuine pattern of coevolution in which you could play a similar game, stretching, of course, your imagination and put yourself in the shoes of the flower and saying, hey, this guy coming over, I'm going to lend my petals. And in fact, I'm going to use some UV design, which they do. So under UV light, you'll see these stripes on the petals that are providing the landmarks for landing. So cannot you picture yourself in their shoes? So if this is always a pattern of coevolution, we are speaking of two agents, not one object and one subject. So that's the type of co-pattern that we need to bear in mind. And if you are able to put yourself in the shoes of one, you should in principle be able to put yourself in the shoes of the other, provided, you know, you train your mind and your brain hard enough to exercise that that power of imagination.
That's very fascinating. You obviously, much of the book is about intelligence and cognition. Of course, it's not only about that. But so we won't get bogged down in intelligence. People have spilt a lot of ink on intelligence and what it is and defining it and all this stuff. And I've had those conversations on the podcast and elsewhere. So, but I guess just give us for you.
Your audience is done with it, right?
No, they're not done with it, but it is something that becomes a very like, kind of people kind of get the conversation kind of sort of slows down with like, well, I define it this way. Well, you define it this way. And it becomes a little tired at some point. But I want to know how are you defining intelligence as relevant to plants? Why is this important? Right? Why is this important to see plants as intelligent as opposed to not intelligent? And when we think of plants, when we see them or we think of them, the first thing I don't think about is, oh, it's so intelligent. That's not my initial kind of prior to looking at plants. So yeah, define intelligence, how you define it, why it's important for plants. And maybe you can give examples of how we might understand some plant intelligence.
Sure. First thing is that when I see a plant, we need to realize that we don't really see them. But I don't mean the plant blindness problem that we already dealt with. That actually, what we do in the lab, we need to time-lapse plants. Otherwise, you just can't see their behavior because their time scale is so slow that we need to speed it up, right? So if you don't speed them up, you just don't see plant behavior. You see a frame, just like a frame, right?
That's nice, yeah.
So it's like a frozen bit of plant life, but it's impossible to see the behavior there because by definition, behavior unfolds in time. So given their time scale, you need to speed them up, right? Except for a few, you know, fast plants that you can see to the naked eye, you know, Venus flytrap or Mimosa pudica, you know, the classics. But 99.9% of plant behavior if you don't speed it up, you're going to miss it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, once you've converged into their time scale through time-lapse clips or photography footage, then you can start to think, hey, what am I seeing here? Is it just a reactive response? I mean, am I simply seeing a plant, you know, performing some phototropic behavior, like, mm-hmm. you know, chasing the sun? Or is something else going on here? So the question is relevant because we want to understand how organisms, and now I don't mean plants, I mean organisms in the tree of life, mm-hmm. anywhere, from unicellulars to us, right? Any form of life whatsoever. What is it that they are able to accomplish? And how do they do it, right? So if first step is I can see plant behavior, if I'm patient enough, I speed them up. Now that I see plant behavior, of course, plant behavior doesn't equate with intelligent behavior. It could be dumb behavior. Mm-hmm. It can be very stupid behavior, right? So we are interested in unearthing those patterns of behavior that point towards high-level functions. Learning, memory, decision-making, problem-solving. So those capacities that we've said that people in the psychology department would be interested in, if only we had plants had neurons. Mm-hmm. And then you say, what is it that they are able to do? Well, if you find a pattern of behavior that is not simply adaptive behavior, right? Because if it's adaptive behavior, that's not such a big deal.
Right.
What's all this fuss about it? It's just adaptive behavior. Okay, good. Good for evolution, right? They wouldn't be here otherwise.
Right.
Clearly, their behavior has got to be adaptive. But the problem is that we are providing a cartoon picture of what is impinging upon plants, like phototropic behavior. Oh, the sun, they care for the sun. They chase the sun as if they were simply chasing the sun. And we forget that plants are surrounded by different information, parameters, biotic and abiotic. So it's all this thing going on. So the plant is chasing the sun, but the gravity pool is always there. So they are going to still be feeling the gravity pool. And some neighbors are producing chemicals. Mm. And the soil is being drained, or there are more nutrients. So it's all these things going on around, in and out, the plant. So first thing is to realize that the environment they live in is way richer than simply responding to one source of stimulation,
yeah.
be it the sun, gravity, water, whatever. So their behavior, in a sense, has got to be flexible enough, right? So plants have got to be sufficiently flexible to change gear and change course of action as different demands come into the picture. So it's not the same to say simply, I'm chasing the sun, than to say I'm chasing the sun whereas or while I'm also monitoring the nutrients below ground and this king or non-king is producing toxins, alerting me that there's this herbivore around. So you see, it's all these things, this breaking news that could be good or bad for me. So the plant needs to be sensing it all, integrating it all, and providing a response that is globally adaptive. So adaptive behavior needs to be flexible, sufficiently flexible to change gear and course, right? And then on top of that, you need to find those flexible behaviors to be sufficiently anticipatory. Because if not, you are simply responding to the environment. So you are kind of like catching up, again, catching up with. And you're always behind, trying to catch up. Now, truly smart behavior to me requires that we predict the future. That in a sense, yeah. I know I'm turning left or I know I'm turning right because in the near future, that's going to pay off. I'm going to avoid this danger or I'm going to find the pocket of nutrient that I wanted to find, whatever. So, and especially if plant life is so slow, you better make sure you know where you're heading. Because if you grow slowly and behavior reduces to patterns of growth, you better know in which direction you are growing, because by the time you get there, it might be too late if you are growing in the wrong direction.
Mm.
So you see, this is not just plant behavior being adaptive. It's got to be flexible. It's got to be anticipatory. It's got to be goal-directed.
Mm.
So they want to reach their goals.
Mm.
Examples from the book, like a vine, right? So if you are a climbing plant, or you want to reach the pole or the host tree, because it makes all the sense to you to intentionally grasp it, because that's the only way for you to twine around and go up there in the canopy and do photosynthesis. Mm. So you need to be dealing with all these contingencies, uncertainties, and projecting into the future. And that's anything but something that can come hardwired in your genes. So they cannot be pre-programmed responses. Mm. You need to be behaving proactively. Mm. That's, to me, what plant intelligence would boil down to, or any form of intelligence for that matter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I usually see intelligence as, problem solving in novel situations. Right? You get a new problem, a new situation,
sure,
and you're having to figure out the problems. Obviously, we've seen this with corvids. You see this with other primates. Different, and there's obviously levels of intelligence as well, of course. But
invertebrate.
But I guess this. I remember reading a book about fungi and
Merlin Sheldrake.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Great book.
Yeah.
And this whole thing of fungi are like us. They have multicellular organisms. And it's interesting because it really turns on its head this idea that intelligence and cognition is just a part of a brain and you need a central nervous system. And it really kind of warps with your mind of like, well, if you don't have a brain and you don't even have a central nervous system, how could you have intelligence? But it is interesting that unless you define intelligence differently, right? So this is where the whole argument goes. But the idea, though, I think you're right, is there is obviously, if you have anticipatory behavior, you have goal-directed behavior, you have all of these ways of adapting, that's not just responding to the environment, right? I mean, of course, it is responding to the environment, but it's not only that in this kind of no way of understanding or planning or organizing or sequencing how they're doing things. And so I guess it does really broaden out how we think about intelligence or cognition. Mm-hmm. So there's this really cool part in the book where you talk about how plants can sun-track. And I use some diagrams in there and everything. They can do it overnight and they can anticipate, the sunrise. Right. Explain to us this. How do plants do this? Because it's absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's an interesting example, because in the philosophy literature, there was this challenge a few decades ago, precisely raised by Andy Clark, that at the time was in Edinburgh, and he was talking about representation-hungry problems. Like, an organism that deals intelligently with whatever things is going on out there requires not simply to respond in online situations, online as in, oh, I'm sun-tracking the sun. Okay, if it's sun-tracking, online sun-tracking, no big deal. The sun is always there. I'm latching onto it, so it's just the two of us couple, right? Mm-hmm. But when the target is not there temporarily, is absent for some time, then you need to deal with somehow, you need to resort to inner representations, for example, of that outside target that is temporarily missing.
Yep.
So that's offline cognition. So that to many people, to the skeptics about plant intelligence, they thought, oh, this is the litmus test. Okay, if you have an example of an offline competency, that's big news, because that's a way to say, hey, they are not simply coupled to the environment. They need to be doing things whilst their object of desire is not out there. Right?
Birds, I believe, do this as well. Bees as well. They do this thing where they can do it offline to know, and they can do it for long, extended periods of time over
navigational capacities. So in this case, I found an example which is maybe it's just the just a way to scratch the surface of the problem. But I thought it was good enough because it was very simple. Hmm. And that's nocturnal reorientation.
Yeah.
So when the plant is sun tracking during the day from east to west, that's online. But at night, when the sun sets, some plants are able to reorient during the night, so in the absence of the sun, be ready facing eastwards prior to the sun rising in the morning. So ready to rock as soon as they reach a few sun rays. And they go, oh, here I am, ready. So it's not catching up. Mm. Delayed is ready in advance. right? So how can they perform this nocturnal reorientation, right? So that's basically, that's in fact, that's a very easy trick. And what they do, I mean, when think that when the sun is hitting you, you start to store, to accumulate starch from sugars, right? Mm-hmm. And so if the sun rises from the east, on the east side of your body, your plant body, you will start to accumulate, to store more starch. Mm-hmm. As the sun goes up, then you will start to accumulate the starch evenly on both sides, mm-hmm. because it's hitting from the top. Mm-hmm. And then as it moves west, blah, blah, blah. So because there is differential starch deposition, right? It's being stored differently because from the east part, it has been stored from the very early morning. Mm-hmm. By the time the sun sets and the plant needs to break it up to get energy, it will have different concentration on each side. Mm-hmm. And that's going to make the water content affect cells differently. So that differential deposition of starch is going to affect the way the plant bends or reorients at night, because cells will have different way of dealing with the different water content in them. So you see, sometimes there is a very easy explanation to things. And the way I like to put it is that when people, again, playing the devil's advocate, would say, hey, you see, you know, physiology explains it all. You know, it wasn't such a big deal. There was nothing cognitive about that. Mm. Then we keep forgetting that a lot of what we consider to be highly complex cognitive phenomena, human phenomena, amounts to many times very simple, decentralized toolkits. So we have a very idealized, inflated version of what human cognition is about. And when other beings do their things, we tend to deflate it, saying, oh, that's just physiology. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it's true in the case of fungi, with Merlin Sheldrake's book, and in my own case with Planta Sapiens, that we can pay due respect to the non-neural, the bodily aspects, or the environmental aspects of a cognitive system, which is truly cognitive, insofar as we understand it as embodied, distributed, decentralized. Mm-hmm. So when people say plants can't afford to be stupid, that many people say that, hey, they can't afford to be stupid because, you know, being sessile, they can't afford to be stupid. But we humans or animals that need to be up and down, hectically moving around, we cannot afford to be stupid. And we evolved a central nervous system as if without it, you couldn't, you could afford to be stupid. And we don't realize that this is just different problems that get solved differently. Mm. So plants don't need to go shopping or to cook dinner. They have sunlight available. Mm. That doesn't make them stupid. That means that their problem is different. Their solutions are different. Mm-hmm. Being sessile, they cannot have essential organs located in specific parts of their body. That they are decentralized. Mm. You sow a branch, they will grow another branch. That doesn't happen to you or me, but we can hide from predators.
Right.
So they have different problems. They come up with different solutions. Mm. The problem is this gold standard we thought we were providing. If the problem of the gold standard runs deeper, it's not just that we tend to humanize or to fall prey of anthropomorphic biases in seeing the rest of the world. It's that we tend to miss what can make them truly intelligent, obsessed with a metric, with a comparative. Mm. If we think that they are intelligent to the extent that they resemble other form of life, we are not truly appreciating their intelligence in their own terms. Mm. We can't help but comparing against another form of intelligence. We need to forget about ourselves and just consider their intelligence in their own terms for themselves, not for ourselves.
Mm. Yeah, it's such a marvel to hear about the sun tracking. And it really, maybe for listeners, it shows that, you know, really caring for plants and giving them the right amount of sunlight if they're indoors is really important. And it's very important. I talked to Andy on the podcast, last year. And we had a lovely conversation. We really got into, you know, some of the extended mind kinds of things and that concept. And this is, you know, this idea that, you know, the mind is not just in your brain and your head, but you see it throughout your body. This even gets, you know, to the piece of you know, some of the work of philosophical work of Merleau-Ponty, who was very interested in the phenomenology through the body. So these ideas, I think, are important because not only do we see them for humans, but we also see them for other organisms as well, such as plants. Mm-hmm. This idea of an extended mind, which is super important. I'll come back to Andy in a minute. But I guess you mentioned earlier this communication, right? So we've been talking communication, obviously language for us in one sense. We have other ways of communicating, but primary language. But other organisms communicate in different ways. You talked about this above ground, below ground kind of thing of how plants communicate. You expand on that a little bit more of how is this communication happening for them?
Sure. Well, I mean, when I spoke about, you know, providing responses that are globally adaptive, that globally adaptive relates to both integrating all channels of information and throughout the whole plant body. Mm. Because what's important to the tips of the shoots or the branches bears upon what the roots apparatus is going to be doing, mm. and vice versa. So it's global at that level. It's the whole plant as such that is the one that is going to be having to provide responses that are globally adaptive, right? Mm. To compensate, for example, in terms of morphology, mass, etc. So there are many different channels. I mean, all sorts of molecules traveling throughout the plant body, but you know, but electrical waves, hydraulic waves, ROS, reactive oxygen species waves, calcium waves, chemicals, volatiles. Mm. So they're making use of all these different channels. Integrating it all, right, in order to provide those global responses. So the fact that they have no neurons, if you think about it, it's irrelevant because they perform and they resort to electrical forms of signaling mm. as part of their communication equipment. Mm. So they are sensing electromagnetic fields, they are sensing chemical gradients, they are sensing all these parameters, and they are using they're making use of all these waves traveling throughout the plant body for the purpose of communication. Mm. So put it this way, maybe this is a good way to understand what we said about, hey, botany cannot deal with this by itself and psychology neither. Mm. If you think of the vascular system of the plant, of higher plants, like the xylem and the phloem pathways, right? So you just for the people unfamiliar, if you think of the phloem pathway like for bringing the sugars throughout the plant from photosynthesis or to bringing the nutrients and the water all the way up from the ground. So you have a bidirectional exchange of substances, right? Now, if you think about the vascular system of a plant from a physiological perspective, we usually think of it as akin to an animal circulatory system mm-hmm. for the translocation of those substances, mm-hmm. right? We've got to think about it from an information processing perspective. Mm. And that's when we are able to put together the cognitive sciences and the plant sciences. Oh, this is not simply translocating sugars or nutrients or water. Oh, this is for the purpose of processing information. Oh, this is an information processing network mm. in pretty much the same way we speak of artificial neural networks or animal neural networks processing information, mm. right? And mm. So when you have take action potentials. You know, it's so funny to many people. In fact, well, that's this is not a spoiler because, you know, Planta Sapiens gets started with this very idea in the introduction, mm-hmm. with the plant being, you know, put to sleep with anesthetics. Mm-hmm. So we know the role of anesthetics, animal anesthetics like isoflurane, that has in neurons. So they effectively prevent the neuron from firing an action potential, right? Mm-hmm. Ions can go across the membrane. Mm-hmm. Well, the very same thing happens with plant cells. So a plant cell or a cell under anesthetics, I insist, under animal anesthetics, the one that vets use right. in veterinary hospitals, they will be anesthetized in the very same way. And the plant will be prevent, those cells, plant cells, will be preventing from firing those action potentials. Mm-hmm. Now, action potentials are part and parcel of plant life. They fire spikes of voltage. And we keep missing it because we don't give it enough importance, or we think it's something anecdotal that maybe belongs to, you know, the Venus flytrap that you touch the inner hair and it snapshots, things like this. But any form of plant life is regulated in part through electrical signaling. So all these channels are combined such that in such a way that the plant is able to put up proactively those responses that we were speaking of.
Yeah, so it's this information that it's also passing, not just nutrients. This is the phyto nervous system, right? Which is a kind of analogous to the central nervous system. Yeah. And I guess understanding that it can, you know, transfer information, that opens up a whole other world of understanding. You know, it's like, right, they don't have neurons, but they do have action potentials. They are able to have these responses. What is the potential or the horizon of what we could discover understanding plants in this way?
Okay, good. No, that's a great question because look, I said at the very beginning that we do time lapse because we need to speed them up to appreciate their behavior, their overt behavior, right? Yeah. But that doesn't mean that their intelligence reduces or can only be identified through overt behavior. So in the very, in fact, I always tell, you know, even here in my students, I always tell them, look, this is way easier than it looks like if you take seriously the idea of drawing the analogies, the comparisons in between the animal and the plant kingdom. So what can you do with animals? You are not only observing their behavior. For example, you can track the neural correlates of brain activity, mental activity, right? So you see, sometimes, you know, you do neuroimaging and they say, hey, let's see what lights up in the subject's brain when it's performing a cognitive task, right? So, okay, when it's rotating this object mentally, this part of the brain lights up, whatever, right? So we do those two things. We observe the overt behavior of the subject and we are able to check the correlations in between the brain activity and those behaviors. So something similar can be done with plants. Mm. So in fact, we do it. So we can register the electrophysiological activity within the plant. So those patterns of information are running across the plant body in the form of those waves that we were speaking of. And then you can check it out. You can actually see it right on the screen and say, hey, why this is important? Not simply to have an idea of the inner doings of the plant, but sometimes it's even so important that, for example, if you're thinking of agriculture engineering, crops, yield, you're concerned with the yield or the harvesting, you might think, oh, I want to know if my plants are being stressed, right? Unnecessarily. Mm. If we are inducing forms of stress that, you know, we could try to get rid of or avoid. Sometimes when you are in agriculture and your crop, you see your field, sometimes the stress you identified far too late. So by the time you see it, by the time that form of stress becomes conspicuous to the naked eye, when you see it, it's too late. Mm. So to take preemptive measures to ahead of time, for example, you can see electrophysiological markers like 24 hours, 36 hours, maybe are flagging that something is going to go wrong. Mm. And you can take those measures to reduce stress before it's too late. So that's an example of an application, but that allows you to peek into the life of plants from those two ends, from the overt behavior end and from the electrophysiological underpinnings.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting because we're understanding, yes, the time lapse element of it, but also that there are things obviously that are happening, I don't want to say static, but more kind of acutely in the moment. Mm. So we mentioned Andy Clark. So in this part in the book, which I was, I'll be very honest, I was very surprised to see the extent of how much you went outside of kind of, you know, plants and such. But you talk about the Bayesian brain, predictive processing. You mentioned Andy Clark and work by the great Carl Friston, both who I've had really lovely conversations here on the podcast. So I guess for this purpose, as you do it in the book, but can you explain perceptual and active interference And I mean, so it's a little complicated, but just kind of the shortened version of that and how it works and potentially works in plants, or how they might be making a simulation of things, or how they're using or not using free energy. What is the things that you gleaned from Andy and Carl that we can try to apply or make steps to apply in plant life?
Right. Okay, good. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's actually, I had great conversations with Andy in Edinburgh in those years leading up to all this research.
He's a lovely man. He is a genuinely sweet person. Very, very nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Absolutely. Yeah, so actually the paper I have in plant predictive processing with Carl Friston, we have a paper from 2017 that came out of these discussions first with Andy and with Carl.
Very nice.
And that that was interesting to see how nicely the theoretical framework fitted into the research I was doing at the moment. So if you think of perceptual inference as in a sense like involving the capacity to interpret this sensory data around you, right? By filling the gaps, you know, just based on the prior knowledge that you have, on the expectations that you are having, right? So in a sense, you've got to be, you know, you are guessing what's coming in from the outside, mm-hmm. sort of throwing those guesses. Okay, that these are my expectations, and then you somehow you know are able to reach inferentially reach those perceptual states by filling in those gaps together with those that prior knowledge that you might have and those expectations, right? Now, if you are on top of that, on top of adjusting those internal models that you might have, right, you are acting onto the world, you are providing something else, right? So you're having an impact. You are changing what the world is like, right? So just think how those two ends of this inferential equation work, like the perceptual and the active sides of it. What in predictive processing, what you are after or what you need to understand is that there are two. We were speaking in the vascular system of a plant of these information processing pathways, right? Now, what you have in predictive processing is the idea of two asymmetrical pathways, because you have the top-down guesses, mm-hmm. so you are guessing things. Those are your expectations, top-down from the inside outside, and the bottom-up sensory signals coming from the periphery. Right. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you need to be making those two things allow for to reduce the error in what you are guessing and perceiving, acting more or less onto the world, but perception is what we call the end state in which the system stabilizes, right? So think of what's happening within a plant. For a plant to be able to play this game of having those two pathways, those two flows of information negotiating the relation, like the top-down and the bottom-up signaling pathways, you need to have a deeper and less deep layers of processing units and some functional asymmetry in between them, such that you have a temporal difference, such that you have the expectation, the guess being thrown out, and then the corrections, you're able to implement it, right? Mm-hmm. So to close the loop by seeing what the world is telling you mm-hmm. with respect to the expectation that you had before, right? Mm-hmm. So if you are able to find in a plant that type of asymmetrical functional dependence in between those two information processing pathways, mm-hmm. then you have a reason to believe that the plant body has the type of implementation required to be a predictive processor of information, right, along those lines.
So was this found in a plant? Were able to measure this?
We don't know yet. Mm. We are that this is still work in progress. it's good to know that. First, one thing very important to bear in mind is that as in the animal literature, we have usually we are usually enslaved by the model the biological model of choice. Mm. In the case of plants, it's Arabidopsis. Arabidopsis is just a tiny plant with, you know, not that exciting physiology compared to other species, but we know a hell of a lot about it, right? Mm. So the like you know, like you might know with C. elegans or Drosophila or any other animal model. Mm-hmm. The problem with these models is that the more you know about them, the more you forget that the plant kingdom is huge.
Yeah.
And what works for one plant species might not work for another. Mm. So if, in this particular case, if you need a vascular system deep enough such that you can play with this asymmetry that is needed to be able to pass along the messages top-down and bottom-up and negotiate those two sources of information, how those two flows have to negotiate their encountering, right? From the expectations out and from the sensory periphery in, then not every plant species might be able to accomplish that.
Mm.
So a mistake in you see, this is another form of plant blindness.
Mm-hmm.
When you say, hey, are plants intelligent? Are plants able to do predictive processing?
Which plants?
Yeah. Right. So think about it. You don't say that in the end. So if I ask, hey, are animals intelligent?
Mm-hmm.
And then people will say, well, are you talking about a dolphin
mm-hmm.
or an earthworm? So who is it you're talking about? Mm-hmm. The fact that we don't raise that question in the plant kingdom means that we are still plant blind even when we think we are not,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
There is a second caveat, if I may, mm-hmm. and it relates to, well, you will have seen in the book that I don't just speak of Andy and Carl's paradigm, predictive processing or free energy minimization. We make use or we resort to other paradigms. And to me, this is a very important message because especially, you know, for master or PhD students, even undergrad, because we are far too obsessed with following the instructions or the footpath of our mentors or one school of thought,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and we don't give enough importance to the role that pursuing the search of intelligence through different paradigms
mm-hmm,
has.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So basically, predictive processing and many other paradigms from within the computational field are approaches to understanding plant intelligence mm-hmm. that rely on positing representational and computational resources.
Mm.
So we rely on an internal model, and then we update the model, and we do many things, but we always speak from the perspective of this model dealing with precisely those offline competencies mm-hmm. when we said we weren't directly in contact with the target, right? Now, those are constructivist models of cognition.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow inferential models of cognition, that there is a lot of cognitive machinery going on in here because, you know, the world by itself, the environment is not giving you the answer. And somehow we have to construct it, to inferentially build it up in our minds.
Mm.
And those models that rely on this idea of inferential and contrastivist approaches some are hybrid or compatible, but the other side of the spectrum is provided by ecological psychology or ecological approaches. So these approaches are precisely denying the very idea that you need to resort to those computational and representational resources and demands.
Mm.
So another way to put it is that whether plants are intelligent or not, it's not something that we need to solve by seeing how they fit within a constructivist framework.
Mm.
They might fit within a non-computational or a non-representational framework.
Mm.
So to me, the best approach is to be pluralistic in spirit and follow them all.
Mm.
So any framework, any theory of cognition, any school of thought that is not tailor-made for humans, mm. as in you need to be a language user, linguistic creatures, or things along those lines, anyone which is neutral with respect to organisms that could be, in principle, be applied to any form of life whatsoever, my suggestion would be to follow them all.
Mm.
Because sometimes this paradigm might deliver the goods,
mm.
either for this competency or for this species.
Mm.
And some other times, this other paradigm might deliver the goods mm. for this other species or for this other competency. So by putting it this other way, we are not handcuffing us to having to have a single explanation for any behavior that we suspect is intelligent to be seen or interpreted only through a single lens. We have all these resources available. Let's use them all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you on that. I do agree that even if something theoretically or even scientifically is powerful, especially if we're working outside of humans, we should be able to look at all of the potential models that are there to say, okay, well, what can we kind of get from this to see what makes the most sense for
sure
for other types of organisms. Mm. So a few questions I have for you here on all of this is based on what we know and the research that's been done on plants, what is it like to be a plant generally? I mean, obviously there are different plants and each one's going to be different of sorts, but you talk about vines making choices, how they make an umwelt, it's this type of world, but what is this going on inside the organism, between the other organism, with other plants in the environment? What can we confidently say generally about plants in the abstract, and what are we still trying to discern?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. What is it like to be a plant, right? Well, here there are two positions. I mean, there are those that simply say, "Hey, there is no way you can figure it out," right? And that's a legitimate response insofar as they apply the same response to any form of life whatsoever, by the way. Mm-hmm. But if you are able to say, no, I hard enough, if I try hard enough, I know what it's like to be my pet, my dog, my cat, because I see my dog all day sitting around, getting excited when I walk him, whatever. And then you are kind of able to, to put yourself in their shoes. Now, if you are able to accomplish that, of course, it's going to be always a limited attempt. You won't be able to truly put yourself, but if you have some idea of what it's like to be your pet, then my suggestion is that you keep trying hard, because you should be able, again, to put yourself in the shoes of other forms of life. Mm-hmm. Why is this? Because first, the most important thing is not to be obsessed with getting within the skull or within the head of your pet or your plant. Mm-hmm. Why? Because what counts, what's way more important at the early preliminary stage is to look outside, to look into the environment and see, hey, what of all the stuff out there is it that they care about? Right? So what are their senses, their sensory modalities? What is it that they are using to scan, to monitor their surroundings? What is it that they, are interested in? Right? Of course, as you said, it's a very different thing to what is it like to be a vine that needs to twine around a host or a pole, from being a carnivorous plant, from being a sequoia tree. There will be very, very different things. But for example, there are things that are important to bear in mind. Take light. If we think of the visible light, the part of the spectrum that we are able to see, we need to bear in mind, or we need to understand, and this is important to understand, how structure affects functionality. Mm. So, this is like the algorithm and the implementation and level, right? Mm. So you see, okay, what is it that they are able to do provided the substrate they have? Mm. So if they have light-sensitive proteins in their tips, we know they have different proteins sensitive to different parts of the spectrum, right? So if plants are able to sense differently bluish, red, far red, UV, green, so if they are able to sense light differently, we can ask what sort of picture they make of their surroundings. And here is very important to understand, to enact it. Not simply to think of the static picture that they might have in their brains or in their heads, square quotes, please. But that you are able to see it in action, to enact it. Mm. Why I'm saying this? How plants, for example, perceive density in the vicinity? How many neighbors potentially, are blocking sunlight? Mm. So they want to grow into the open space, right? Mm. Because they want to, you know, do photosynthesis and they don't want to have too many guys around.
Right.
So they need to find their spot.
Mm.
What they are doing is they are sensing the ratio of red to far red light and the ratio of blue to green light. Mm. So why are those ratios important? Because plants are absorbing blue and red and they are reflecting green and far red. So that's why you see them green, right?
Mm.
So if they are absorbing more red than far red, the ratio of red to far red is going to be highly informative. Mm. It's going to tell you how many guys are there. But check out, they won't be able to take a snapshot. So they can only see how that ratio changes as they grow towards or away from one place.
Mm.
So if I'm growing left and the ratio goes down, oh, something is happening here. The ratio of red to far red, right? Mm. So if the ratio goes up, oh, so you can see whether you are turning left or right, whether you have more guys around you or not. Mm. So when you see, now go back to the idea of putting yourself in the shoes of your pet. When you see your dog wagging its tail and as you walk him and you say, oh yeah, sure, I know what my dog is feeling. He's excited about going for a walk, being all day at home. And then you see a plant when you speed it up through time-lapse photography, of course. And then you see that the plant is doing this.
Mm.
It's not the same simply to think, oh, my damn plant is simply growing, than to say, oh, it's monitoring whether the ratio is going up or down.
Mm.
And now it's, you know, like kids playing cold, cold or hot, hot when you they are trying to, you know, mm-hmm. blindfolded, they need to find the present, mm-hmm. the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So saying cold or hot only makes sense with respect to the path they've chosen.
Mm.
I walk left and then you say cold, 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 and then I walk right. So that's what the plant is doing. The plant is saying, okay, oh, the ratio goes up. Oh, the ratio goes down. Oh, this is the perfect spot for me to grow. You see? So this means that playing these games or putting ourselves in their shoes has a lot to do, not simply with, it's not a mental exercise of the powers of imagination. It has a lot to do with scientific knowledge. So if you have all that knowledge about the plant physiology, the plant ecology, and of course, the ecophysiology, the developmental biology underneath. So all that together is what is going to allow you to appreciate or to interpret their behavior in a way that is that you are able to see which patterns of behavior are intelligent. Oh, now I understand why the plant is doing this movement.
Mm.
Oh, it's trying to catch that pole.
Mm.
They are actually responding to different. This is something I mentioned in the book.
Mm-hmm.
They respond to different colors. So if the pole is red or yellowish or brownish, or they will target for the pole differently. And that's something you can see in the kinematic.
Mm.
I mean, you can see in the velocities and you can see how the plant is trying to reach the pole differently depending on the color it's made of, right?
Mm.
So with a little bit of, you know, getting rid of some prejudices and some solid scientific knowledge, it's not that, you know, a stretch of imagination, if only we are able to do it step by step. In one shot, I grant you, we are not going to get there. But if you grant me that we are able to put ourselves in the shoes of fellow humans, mammals, pets, oh, maybe we just need to keep playing that game.
Hmm. It's interesting. As you were talking about this, I kept thinking back to what you were saying about it being goal-directed and all these things. And I wonder about this element, both for, you know, plants that people have in their home or on their balcony or whatever, their garden, or even out in the world, this element of time, right? Like it's you're saying it's moving towards this pole, it's moving towards this, you know, kind of, you know, based on colors and discriminating with the ratio. But you can have plants in your home for 10 years, longer, if you take care of them and all these things. I mean, obviously time is something that we, you know, put as a measurement and things like that. But is there, and you mentioned in the beginning that there's a kind of, even to see some of the behavior, you have to do a time lapse. It seems that plants work at a different speed and even to observe them. But What about over long periods of time, 20, 30 years or longer, if they're able to survive that long, if they're outside, against the elements or predators like humans and other animals trying to eat them? What is this idea in terms of like very long future? I mean, maybe hard to know, but maybe is there something to show about plants that, don't make it, don't only pass a year, let's say, and then other plants that make it 20, 30 years? What is the differences we know?
Yeah, sure. Well, here we have an extra problem that we haven't covered yet, and it's the difference in between domesticated and wild species.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Why I'm saying this? Because in a sense, if you are walking in your neighborhood and see this big tree out there, and then you start to think of the form, the morphology, oh, how it's shaped, the branches.
Yeah.
In a sense, you can travel past in time and you can see those branches, the shape they had, that has to do with the pressures, the constraints that were applicable 50 years time when that branch was growing and decided to grow this way and not that way, right? So in a sense, by looking at the morphology, you can guess what that form of life went through, right? Many years ago, because it's imprint in its morphology, in the very morphology, right? Now, the problem we have here is that we prune them, we chop their branches, we sculpt them. So domestication in plants means we develop actively their phenotype. We shape them into the shape we see, right? So we need to go more to primordial forests and see what trees and plants look like when they haven't been sculpted by us.
Yeah.
Because I'm not even talking about pruning them. I'm just talking about the way we plant them. So if we plant trees in lanes, right, equidistantly, so every 2 yards, one tree, all lined up, then they are all, even if you didn't prune them, they will all shape equally because they will have equal amounts of open air around surrounding them. So they are giving this artificial space in which they don't find anything to fight against. So we provide this sterilized environment in which they just simply grow. But if you go for the wild counterpart, primordial forests and the like, then you will find that they are all shaped differently. They vary so much. You won't find two guys the same. They will be so incredibly different because they are reflecting the actual constraints that each individual has gone through. Oh, I was on this slope, and then there were these other guys here, and then this other non-king were doing their business over there, and then I could sense those chemicals. So they are, and I had to go through that little, make the most out of those little sunflakes because the canopy is dense. And so you will see that the morphology that they end up having, the shape that they end up having after, as you said, 30, 40, 50 years, truly reflects what they have gone through in life.
Is that also where we get to see more of, if you will, quote, individuality or even maybe personality of a plant?
Absolutely. Definitely. So think that, go back again to the idea of the climbing bean and the pole, right? There's a main character in the book, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, those we keep forgetting that those guys we bring to the lab are, we've been domesticating them for 10, 12,000 years. It's called agriculture. So that means that we've been literally sticking a pole next to them for thousands of years. So if you stick a pole next to me to twine around for thousands of years, I become spoiled. I don't need to work hard. I mean, this is our spoiled children, the equivalent. to our kids at home watching TV, eating popcorn. So they don't need to worry about anything. The fridge is full of food and that's it. So if you go to the wild counterparts, they will behave dramatically differently. Now, this is important as well because as we are shaping their morphology, that bears upon the behaviors they are able to exhibit because of the very body constitution they have. So domesticated individuals, the ones we domesticated through agriculture, are dwarfed. So for example, the distance in between nodes, the internode length, mm-hmm. shortens. Mm. So if that distance shortens because they have the pole, they don't need to stretch, mm. those guys are going to have way less exciting movements of circumnutation. So they won't revolve dramatically mm. to monitor their surroundings. They don't have to. Mm. They have a pole. Mm-hmm. So if you go to the wild vines, you'll see that the internode lengths are way longer. Mm. And this means that these guys, out of mere morphology, they are going to balance and counterbalance way more. Mm. So those guys will move way more, you know, different. So not so regularly. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're going to be able to monitor way more gradients. Oh, many more things are going around me because I need to reach out and find, because I need the target, I need the pole to twine around, and nobody's bringing it to me.
Wow. Yeah, that's... I will forever look at plans differently after the conversation. That's deeply fascinating. I guess the last big question here, which is something I was thinking about reading throughout your whole book, was two questions. I'll give you the first one. Do they feel pain? And and if they do, how can we know it? And if we know they feel pain, and we can kind of know it, what does that mean of how we interact with them? So I'll come to that bit in a minute. Mm. But yes, do we think they feel pain or some analogous element of pain, something like that, whatever it is from?
Sure.
What do we think about this?
Yeah. So this is another $1 million question. Now, you know, you open for your very last question a huge can of worms. Okay. So the not so short answer is we are so selfish that we think that the molecules that they biosynthesize simply come handy to us. And we know the effect those molecules have on us.
Yeah.
Ask pharmacists.
Right.
So take phytomelatonin, right? So melatonin, the melatonin tablets that you take when you cross the pond and you are jet lagged, or that you, when you need to go to, you know, to hit the sack and you can't sleep, and then you take some melatonin, synthetic melatonin. We know the effect that has on us, right? Mm-hmm. Puts us to sleep.
Yeah.
Plants biosynthesize their own melatonin, right? So when legumes, again, think of the climbing bean. So legumes in general, this leaf folding behavior, nictinastic behavior. So they fold their leaves at night, right? When they fold their leaves, if I said the plant went to bed, people would say, "Oh, Paco is speaking metaphorically," right? Now, if you measure the concentration of melatonin within the plant being biosynthesized by them, you will see that the temporal profile is the same as in animals. So you have a peak before dawn, so before the sun sets, you have this peak, and then the second peak, then it wears off during the day. So it's the very same concentration dynamics that you find in animals. Now, we are so arrogant that even knowing the physiological role of melatonin and knowing that plants produce their own melatonin, we cannot come to terms with the idea that non-neural forms of life are going to be using that, even when we see them folding their leaves at night, even when we know that the sleep has to do with DNA recovery, with putting the machinery back in course, because, you know, living, you know, produces waste and we need to do things about it. I mean, you couldn't be awake 24/7. So any form of life needs to take a break, right? So when they take their break, when you see that the peaks in melatonin are similar to animal peaks in melatonin, we still don't quite get it. Even actually, if I told you, if imagine I cross the pond and meet you in person and I fly to the US with a pet, a dog or a cat in a cage, as some people do, right? If I got to, you know, JFK, I would be thinking, oh, my poor dog is got to be as jet black as I am. We need a rest. If you were traveling with a potted plant, I bet you would never think that about your plant.
Never.
And yet, melatonin in plants allows them to put them back in sync with the circadian clocks and the day-night cycle. Mm. So they have circadian clocks. They have a central clock the way we do. Mm. They can be entrained with the same cues, temperature, relative humidity, day-night cycles, photoperiod. Mm. So all that's happening, and yet we can't quite say they are jet-lagged, right?
Right.
Now, if you go to stress and to pain and suffering, we know that plants are releasing ethylene, DNA ether. So the very same molecules with anesthetic properties that we find in animals, they release those molecules with anesthetic properties at points of stress. So we are again so arrogant that we say, oh, these molecules come handy, you know, ethanol, you know, all those. So we know those molecules come handy. We can make patents, we can use them, we can synthesize this stuff, and we know how to use them. And we know they come handy when, you know, they take you to the surgical room and you need to be anesthetized to undergo a surgical operation. But if it's a plant that is biosynthesizing those molecules with those properties, when they are being stressed, we still don't want to accept that something has got to be going on there. So again, to me, the very problem is that we haven't get rid of this Copernican navel-gazing point of view that we think we are still the gold standard and the center of the universe. Mm. If there is something that, to me, the central message of Planta Sapiens is that there's got to be something that unites us all in the tree of life, regardless of implementation details. So I don't care if you have neurons and I don't, if you walk and I grow, but there's got to be something that unites us all. And you know why? Because that something has to do not with the finer grain details of our divergent bodies, but what's out there, because we inhabit the same house. Planet Earth is our home. And we are being united despite diversity because that planet Earth that we live in is providing the same cues. So the day-night cycle is the same for all of us. That's why we have all evolved circadian clocks. And you don't need a central nervous system for that. So you see, those cues are so important. Those regularities, planetary regularities, are so important that any form of life would be damned not to have evolved toolkits to deal, to exploit, informatively speaking, those regularities. Mm. So they could be doing it neurally or non-neurally. But how the heck would they afford not exploiting regularities that are out there systematically around the clock? Mm. So this is a long way to say, well, yeah, if we weren't less arrogant, we might realize that what is the reason for a living organism to release, to biosynthesize molecules with anesthetic properties when being stressed, if it was not to deal with that stress? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly gives more questions than answers, but I mean, it definitely has a kind of directionality to it of like, there is something there. The other can of worms connected to this is...
now what? No, the now what question.
No, not that one. That's the one after. The question kind of sort of connected to this is, well, what about vegans and vegetarians? people that are vegetarian.
They have a problem.
Yeah, because we were so fixated on our food has a face and all these things with animals and all these things, and it's just plant-based, all of these things. And I've always wondered, well, if we think that there's some sentience or there's some cognition or there's some intelligence or there's these things with plants and all of these things that you're saying, and we have the same molecules or similar ones, and we have all these things going on. Well, what are we doing? If we're eating, if we're eating plants, if we're consuming that amount of plants, so what do we say to people that have been vegetarian? I mean, I've been vegetarian at different points. You know, I kind of wax and wane on it. But what do we say to folks that do that, or even to vegans that do that? What's the answer here?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a fair question, and there is an answer. Okay, how can I put it? ethics, ethical dilemmas, have to do with the treatment of individuals, not the treatment of categories. So abstract categories, we don't have an issue with those because they don't exist. Those are abstractions. So the animal kingdom, as such, is an abstraction. I don't care about the category dolphins. I care about this dolphin that I'm poking my finger into his eyeball right now. So this means that we are so obsessed with taxonomy that we don't realize that, you see, the very way of framing the question, oh, I'm a vegan vegetarian, what does it mean? It means that you don't eat food that comes from the animal kingdom, as if the category itself was what was securing a fair treatment. So this means that, imagine we get rid of categories, get rid of frontiers, of borderlines, and we just speak of the tree of life and animals or organisms in general, right? So forms of life throughout the tree of life. Isn't it more fair to ask whether that individual that ends up on my dish, on my table, went through some unnecessary form of stress induced by us prior to getting to my table, regardless of the kingdom of precedence, right? So I don't care which kingdom it came from. The question is, did we do something that we could have avoided? So we need to eat.
Yes, we do.
Okay? We need to eat. Right. But you might find out that this individual, again, I insist, this individual, this chicken, might have gone through a happy life, if it's not, you know, intensive farming, as opposed to some green, some vegetable that was, you know, incredibly stressed unnecessarily through some, you know, intensive agricultural production. So why don't we think of the actual individual rather than which kingdom it belongs to?
Well, the counter would be, that's not possible. We have 8 billion people on the planet. We can't spend time. We got to scale this up, Paco. We got to feed people. We got to make sure people aren't. We got to just get it going. That would be the counter, I would imagine.
Yeah, sure. No, I entirely agree. So I'm not being. Sure. I entirely take your point. So I'm not saying there is an easy answer. I'm saying that the way to phrase it or to address it is wrong. We're starting from the wrong perspective. But let me say something else. Because there is this attitude that I have found in academia. So many skeptics about plant sentience, the very possibility of plant sentience, deny that very possibility on the grounds that were plants to be conscious or to have subjective experiences or to be sentient, the type of bearing or that would mean something unbearable to us. So we couldn't sleep tight if plants. So we have to separate those two issues, the implications from the very fact. So if there is a fact of the matter, if it's a factual thing, if there is a fact of the matter to be discovered scientifically as to whether this form of life is sentient or not, that is a scientific question to be pursued with a scientific method, quite regardless of the now what question. So you cannot say they cannot possibly be sentient because then now what?
If they are, they are.
A different issue is what we do now.
I totally agree with you on that. The framing is essential. So the last question is, you know, the now what, right? It's the future, right? Where do we do in the future, right? Obviously, we, you know, climate change is always a kind of ever-present thing, and it's impacting many different plants and all organisms on the planet. But how do we have a future that, you know, respects and sees plants, you know, as individuals in their various environments, and how we have a healthier interaction with them?
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, from the book, I mean, in the epilogue, I speak quite a bit about education and how little satisfied I am with the type of education we have and what we are doing with our children. So we have a tension here. This is a big issue because the measures that need to be taken are the short term. We don't have that much time left, right? I mean, there is really an emergency. But the type of policies and things that need to be done require a way longer time scale. So education takes time. We are talking about generations that have to go through a different way of relating, of how we see the way we relate with the environment. Now, those two things, that cannot be sped up, I'm afraid. So education takes time. But it's true that even in nowadays, you know, think of, you know, people doing environmental studies. So you see how deeply rooted this plant blindness is in us, that even people studying environmental studies, environmental sciences, they keep speaking of resources. So plants are resources, to be exploited better or worse, but still to be exploited. So insofar as we keep speaking of resources, like of objects, and we simply discuss which way to exploit those objects, we are doomed. And we can only get started to contribute to a global change in our mind frames by truly shifting perspective into a perspective in which plants are seen as agents, truly in the business of their doing their own meaning making, with their own intentions, their own desires, their own ways of being around in the world as any other form of life, right? Mm-hmm. Now, to me, what's really difficult is that if there is going to be a way out of this mess we have created, it has to do, paradoxically, with forgetting about ourselves. Mm. Because insofar as we care about plants for our own sake, we are still doomed, because we simply think of them as, oh, we need them for the oxygen, for the clothing, for the food. So we don't think of them for themselves.
Yeah.
So I think that the very best way to approach it, paradoxically, is to forget about ourselves. Because, no, plants deserve to be given due respect,
of course,
regardless of the fact that we need them. What do you mean to say? If we didn't have an emergency, we shouldn't care about them? No, we need to care about them, because it's morally the right way to behave, because they are sentient beings, because they are alive, living creatures with their own, you know. So how could you not care about, you know, doing bad to them? So quite regardless of whether that contributes more or less to you know, this climate emergence and everything. I know this is difficult, and I'm not providing any answer. I can't see any other way that to chill out, slow down, sit back and relax, and try to look at the world from their point of view. Maybe using their time scale helps. Like slow down. That's definitely something we need to do.
Mm-hmm. I fully agree with you. Well, one way people can be educated is getting your book, Plant the Sapiens, which is just a marvelous book. I greatly enjoy it. Highly recommend it. Paco, this was too much fun. I could keep going and going and going and going. This is, illuminating. It was thought-provoking. I really enjoyed the time with you. So big, big thanks for giving me your time, your energy, your knowledge. It's very valuable. So much appreciated.
Yeah, no, well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Time flies. 1 hour and a half and really flies.
That's right.
No, thank you so much.